You're listening to a podcast from 702.
6 minutes after 10 o'clock, this hour, as promised, we're going to be looking at the unemployment rate, which has risen to 27.6%, and that is on the narrow definition. It is not the real number, but even if it was the real number, we would still have a crisis on our hands in terms of the economy, and that means the democracy itself is under pressure, because the links between unemployment and the fabric of society is one that is plain and everyone can see. What will happen if we don't deal with it? So I'd ask three excellent guests to give some thought to the matter. Not that I needed to ask them that. This is what they do for a living anyway. And they join me now on the phone. We've got policy analyst and co-director of the Institute for Economic Justice, Neil Coleman. Neil, good morning, and thanks so much for being on the show today.
Good morning, yes it is.
And here with me in the studio in Johannesburg, I've got two guests that have certainly no strangers to this show. Tabi Leoka is here with us, economist. Tabi, it's wonderful having you on the show. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
And next to her is Isabel Fry, of course, is the Director of Studies in Poverty and Inequality Institute. Isabel, good morning to you as well.
Morning, Eusebius, and morning to your listeners.
I wonder whether we can start, Isabel, firstly with you. We know the top line number, but I think it is very important that we just give a little bit of detail to it. And let's go through it very slowly. 27.6% is quite a scary number. The unfortunate truth is that the situation is worse than that when you take into account a range of things. We know there's a narrow definition. How does the government collect the stats that go into this number, and why is that number not the real number? When we talk about the expanded definition, what are the differences?
Thanks, Eusebius. It is quite important to understand how the figures are made up. There's that saying that says lies, damn lies in statistics. But to understand how government, the definition that government uses, there are two definitions that are used globally by the ILO, the International Labour Organization, the narrow and the expanded definition. Mm. The narrow definition that you cited of 27.6% excludes people who are discouraged work seekers and not seeking employment. So beyond the 27.6%, which is roughly about 6.2 million people, the expanded definition, which includes those who've given up, is 38%. Now, if one looks at that in terms of total numbers, of the 6.2 million people who formerly unemployed in the narrow definition, we have an additional 15.4 million people who are of working age who are not considered within those statistics. So of that, 3 million have officially given up looking for work, and an additional 12.7 million people are called other. Now, other is defined as neither employed nor unemployed, and yet they're working age, they have dependents, they have family, and they don't have access to any form of social security. So I think, to my mind, that's the frustrating thing, is when we're looking for a suitable solution, we need to know the real size of the problem. And so we've got 16.2 million people who are officially employed, including the informal sector, domestic workers and the agriculture. But we've got 21.6 million people who are not employed. And that is also why parts of the economy are so static, because people are not able to actively engage. And you're going to have to keep me, sort of shut me up at a certain time, because I think it's really important.
Yeah,
no,
I'm not going to shut you up, because you're infinitely wise and you're very lucid. I wanted to ask you also, I thought I heard a government official, Isabel, defining what it means to be a job seeker. To be counted, you actually have to do a lot of things. So even when we contrast that with the job, the person who is so disillusioned with the job market, they don't even go out to look for a job. You have to, in order to get into the official stats, something like try at least 4 days a week to find a job over a 4 week period. I mean, that's quite a high threshold requirement for Stats SA to recognize you as actively seeking a job.
It is, and especially when you look at the fact that people who are looking for jobs generally don't have money in order to take the transport. But I think it's also important to recognize that Stats SA is very generous in how they define employed. Okay. So even if you have in the week within the survey that they're looking at improved your home, so there's been no financial transaction, no one's paid you, but you've done something which has improved your dwelling, then you're considered to be employed. So all in all, the definitions are can be quite tricky and they're important to understand. But I would also urge us to look at the impact going forward, as you say.
Absolutely.
I think for me, the challenge being in the youth cohort, 15 to 24-year-olds, we've got 69% of people who are unemployed. Generally, those are people who haven't had a first job.
Mm.
And, I mean, as I often caution, those are the people who are meant to be replacing you and I in terms of the labor market. So when they come in, well, basically, they're not coming in. That declines with age cohorts, but I think that's really a very large question.
Isabel, I want to stick with you for another stat before we bring in the other two guests. In your Daily Maverick piece, you do a comparison not just with global north industrialized countries, but also unemployment figures in sub-Saharan Africa. We do horribly compared to our neighbors, the region, and not just countries in the global north. And that's very important as well.
Absolutely. So the I'm using April 2019 figures, so very current figures. For sub-Saharan Africa in general, the aggregate is 6.1% in terms of unemployment. So we fall horribly short there. The other figures to look at, I often look at Brazil because that's frequently cited as comparator. There you're looking at 13.1%. South Korea, which in about 1984 was very equal to us in a number of our indicators, they've reduced their unemployment to 4.9%. And I think the alarming thing, if you look at, for instance, Venezuela, their unemployment figure being 33.3%, and we can see the unrest and the destabilization that has gone to the heart of the democracy, which is how you introduced this show. Taken all together, we really need to look at new ways of doing things. Interestingly, Namibia and neighboring, formerly known as Swaziland, have unemployment figures of 24.5 and 28%. Mm. So again, that gets into the very complicated issue of the resource curse, where you have extraction rather than beneficiation. But in essence, I hope what we take home is that this 25 years of saying the trickle-down effect will work.
Mm.
We just need to let it time. Give it time.
We're going to come to that, yeah. The reason why I wanted to spend 10 minutes on the stats is that people can understand exactly what the stats communicate. Mm. We will also have more than enough time in the second half of the show, especially Neil and Tubby, to talk about what we shouldn't do and what we should do. I want to spend a couple of minutes, Tubby, talking about the stats that have just been explained so well by Isabel. What are the implications of that for society? In other words, what does that do to human beings? How does that translate into a society that is in distress?
Isabel mentioned the youth unemployment that is over 60%. But even, of the youth, so the 10.3 million persons aged between 15 and 24 years, 33.2% are not in employment, education, training. That is a huge amount. And if you look at a broader sense, so from 15 years to 65 years, that number is closer to 40%. So how do you expect to grow an economy when you have 40% of your working population that is not working, that is not contributing towards productivity? And so that is a clear indication of why the South African economy has struggled to grow over the past, you know, I would even argue 25 years, because the unemployment rate on average is above 25% if you look at the long-term average.
Yes.
And it's also disappointing that we haven't figured out a way of ensuring that this is this number is reduced. If you look at all the other countries that have been in similar position, and Brazil is often, as Isabel said, cited as a competitive country. Brazil was able to take their unemployment rate, I think at their lowest point was 4.3%, just before they had their political crisis. And they did all sorts of things. They ensured they incentivized the poor. They made sure that their social grants, the equivalent of social grants, were a lot more beneficial. They were very creative around that. For instance, they gave money to women as a way of social grants. And then you could only get the money if you take your child to school and also if you take your child to hospital for your annual checks. And what that does is that it alleviates alleviates the pressure from hospital, but ensures that your child is educated.
Yeah.
What also we're seeing in, let's say, Brazil versus South Africa, even on social grants, is that the dependence on social grants is reducing versus in South Africa, where it's increasing. And you see the politicization of it, where politicians laud themselves for being able to increase or wanting to increase or even campaigning around increasing social grants, whereas they should be working towards the opposite.
So,
the fact that we... the unemployment rate is not just a number that is released every quarter that we can just look over. It just shows the systematic problems of our society. It talks to poverty. It talks to education, which is what something I also wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
It also speaks to the structure of the economy and how we're not interrogating it.
Mm.
And I know I've argued, that I've mentioned this on your show before, that the structure of the South African economy is the same as the structure of the UK economy, despite there being very high percentage of educated people and better education in the UK versus South Africa. We cannot grow the country given how, the statistics that Isabella has also mentioned. Mm. When the services industry is a driver of our economy, or the fastest growing sector of our economy.
I want to bring you in here, Neil. The infographic that you tweeted has, amongst other things, the stat of the reality of 33.2% of South Africans between 15 and 24, the one that Tubby has also mentioned, not being employed or in education or training. And there will be some overlap and some disagreement between the three of you about what should and should not be in the solution space. We'll get to that. But I mean, just describe to me what the impact is of that reality. She's mentioned poverty, and obviously the other thing is inequality gets exacerbated. And for me as a political commentator, as I said yesterday on social media, can we be surprised that so many South Africans are increasingly cynical about the state, about their stake or lack thereof in society when they are jobless? And for better or worse, the contingent history of work is such that people see their sense of dignity as partly inhering in whether they're employed.
Yes, you see, the frightening thing is that we are actually facing a national emergency, which in any other society would see the society completely up in arms.
Mm.
And yet we go from a quarterly labor force survey to the next one, talking about percentage points.
Yeah.
But actually what we're talking about is a massive, massive waste of human resources in our country. I mean, if you look at those figures of unemployed youth from 15 to 24 years old, 31% of them are graduates, and 11.4%, there's an increase of 11.4% of that age cohort who are unemployed. So the notion that by simply training and educating we're going to deal with the unemployment problem is clearly incorrect. And so if you look at the not in education, employment or training, young people from 15 to 24 years, I mean, largely, particularly in a society like ours, shouldn't be really the primary target for employment. They should be in education and training, largely. So that confronts the question of how we absorb that particular age cohort.
Yeah.
But for the unemployed as a whole, another frightening statistic in the quarterly labor force survey is that the long-term unemployed, and here we're talking about people who are still, Isabel spoke about discouraged workers who are no longer looking for employment. Of those who are looking for employment, 6.2 million have been unemployed for a year or longer. So in other words, that SA categorizes them as long-term unemployed.
Yeah.
And that number has gone up from 4.4 million in 2008. Has gone up from 2.5 million to 4.3 million since 2008. So the problem of structural unemployment, what we mean by structural unemployment, is that regardless of the fluctuations in economic cycles, whether there's growth in the economy or contraction, those people still remain unemployed. It's a fundamental structural problem, which is what Tabi was referring to.
Okay. I want to move now to one of the substantive questions in relation to what the drivers are around this, to try and understand, we can't pick between the different tools in the toolkit for dealing with this particular crisis, Isabel, unless we understand exactly what drives it. Now, I know a little bit from chatting to you over the last day or so that one thing which is a negative argument, I also want to hear your positive analysis, as in what do you think the actual drivers are, but you've also got some views on what doesn't work, and I know Neil does as well, which he wants to talk about. For you, it's very clear that while growth is a precondition for getting employment up, that growth alone doesn't guarantee a trickle down, neither of the wealth that you might and the value you might generate with new business, but also that a growth-focused discussion without any qualifiers in detail doesn't guarantee that you're actually tackling the unemployment crisis. Just unravel that for me a little bit.
Sure. I think I would define this as a catch-22 situation, because you have people who are not entering the labor market. Linking to one of your questions and what Tavi and Neil referred to, it's critical to see that 56% of people who are unemployed don't have a matric. So education is a massive foundational tool to enable you to enter, to roll that six and to start
That's
the game.
True, yeah. And graduates have single-digit unemployment.
Graduates do. So this is across all ages. People with matric have 34% of the unemployed have matric. 2.1% of graduates of unemployed are graduates. But what's interesting is other tertiary comes in at just under 7%. Okay. So there is still a kind of double layer there. So universities are the ones that are most likely to guarantee access to employment. So again, the question of why are people not making matric? I think that's crucial. Why are people dropping out of education when the returns are so statistically obvious? But going back to your real question, which I think is probably going to have a lot of us talking, why trickle-down doesn't work. In essence, the structure of our economy, which both Tavi and Neil were talking about, is a very concentrated one. So access, the capture of the profits that are made are captured by the upper 20%, the upper 9 and 10 income deciles. That which gets released in addition doesn't enable people. It's not thoroughly circulated amongst society. And it goes to, again, it's part of the cause and the implication of inequality. What we're saying is, given that access to income is not coming through employment, we need to look at other ways. And so what Tavi was saying about not being able to kickstart the economy, if you're able to redistribute to those who don't have access to income, you can kickstart from the bottom up. People talk about township economies, SMMEs, but if there's nobody with available access to available income, who's going to support that? So it's not going to happen. So your profits get drained to your whitey bessons, to those few who are able to look at massive distribution across the country. But in addition to that, the question about the trickle-down is that it depends on some kind of stimulus for growth. For me, one of the critical problems that we're facing is, if you look at the National Development Plan, and many people still do, their predictions about unemployment was that by 2020,
we're gonna miss
them. By 2020, unemployment was going to have dropped to 14%, by 2030 to 6%. I mean, we're also, according to the NDP, going to eliminate poverty by 2030. But the problem is that's all premised on 5% growth. And the IMF recently dropped us to 1.2% in their prediction for 2019. There's no measure that happens. There's no plan B. So we're not making plan A. And when I spoke to a couple of people in leadership positions within the ruling party in the run-up to the elections, and I said, what is going to happen about poverty? I was told that the position is that we have trickled down.
Can I box with you a little bit, Isabel? Mm-hmm. Are you saying, when all is said and done on your analysis, right, and you guys have got, between the three of you, very different ideological entry into this discussion than the folks that Cyril was hanging out with yesterday in Westcliff. Are you saying that the government does not understand where the most important obstacles to employment lie? Because Cyril is going around with his begging bowl and speaking to Goldman Sachs and co.
I'm saying that the policies that have been adopted do not appear to be rooted in any form of empirical evidence. I mean, if you look at the youth wage subsidy, many people both from the left and right, said it's not going to work. To pay an employer to employ someone who is not within the labor market is not going to guarantee them permanent jobs, and it hasn't worked. So the people who are advising are steeped in orthodoxy, which has been disproved even by the World Bank. So the wrong people are being listened to.
Neil and Tabby, don't be so polite. Get into this conversation. What are the drivers? What is not the drivers? I mean, I've seen, Neil, in your position paper, I'm still working through it, but the bits that I've read, I've loved, where you talk about there are no quick fixes, but also you say that things that sound really cool, like cutting expenditure, being prudent, all of that kind of stuff, it sounds really great, lean and mean, but that they can have a depressive effect on employment in key sectors. Just take us through that. Like, for example, the construction sector is one that you mentioned.
So the issue is that you need stimulus in an economy. If you cut back and contract, then you're going to kill off growth. And the construction sector is one example which relies very heavily on public sector investment. There's an economist by the name of Dumit Mabula who's written a piece in the Business Day in which he shows the massive drop in public sector spending and investment which has taken place over recent years and the devastating impact that had. And he compares that to the period between 2003 and 2008 where the economy grew at around 4.8% over a five-year period. And he shows that there was a massive increase in fixed investment by the public sector, by public corporations, et cetera, et cetera. So the point, I think there's three types of interventions which are possible, you see. I don't think we must get trapped in the notion that you either have quick fixes or you have long-term solutions. It's about a combination of interventions. So the first issue is that the state has access to very powerful economic levers. You know, when we hear about the U.S. Fed, the U.S. Reserve Bank, reducing interest rates, or the European Central Bank reducing interest rates, and the massive impact that has both in their own countries and globally. You know, these are very, very powerful levers in terms of, you know, public sector investment. You know, you've seen what the Chinese government did during the global financial crisis, huge investment in their economy. So you've got macroeconomic policies, public spending, the channeling of investment, making cheap credits accessible. So those are levers which are immediately available to the state and can have an impact on the short term. The second is the type of stabilization measures along the lines of what Isabel's talking about, which is giving people access to more income, social protection, you know, reducing the cost of food, reducing the cost of transport and health, getting youth into further education and training, and addressing the stressed sectors where you stabilize jobs, like has been done in the clothing and textile sectors. And then the third type of intervention are what you could call structural transformation, in which we deliberately go out to diversify the economy, and we move away from the narrow reliance on commodities and the excessive focus on financialization of our economy currently, away from speculation into real investment in the real economy. And that has to be a domestic, both South African as well as a regional. You've got to do all those three things simultaneously.
And we'll come back to some of them in the second half, Neil. I was trying to predict, Tabby, where you will locate yourself between Isabel and Neil. Because while we all share the urgency of dealing with the crisis, reading the numbers accurately for what they imply for the state of the state and for the state of our democracy, Neil talks about certain solutions not being a business as usual solutions because they're not going to work, including the idea of cutting back on spending. And then I think to myself, Khona, as a taxpayer, I cannot afford this government to keep on ballooning. I love the idea of BIG, which we'll get to a little bit later, but at whose expense? I'm already stretched as a middle-class taxpayer. Do you agree with what Neil has just fleshed out?
So a bit of both. I agree with what Neil has said, and I want to talk about also the structural unemployment and education and then go into the economy. The only thing that I disagree with Neil on, and I often disagree with Neil on, is the cutting.
Many people
cutting interest rates to stimulate growth. We've done it before, and it has minimum effect when the economy is slow and there's low demand. So if you cut interest rates, but I still can't afford, even if you cut it by 25 basis points or 100 basis points, it's not going to make much difference. What I like, though, is these other solutions of the government then stepping in and, you know, feeding schemes, similar to what we saw in Brazil, where they took an active role in preventing and in securing the poor. The problem, though, with the South African government at the moment, it's very, we don't have the money to do so. I mean, Brazil did
all. And we don't have the government yet.
Yeah, we don't have the government yet, but also don't have the fiscus to do so. Mm. And typically reform happens, or successful reform happens, when there's global growth, so that whatever you're doing, you know, domestically, you're supported by a global growth. So your country doesn't go into stagnation as you're reforming, because reform is disruptive. Mm. But unfortunately for us, we don't have the fiscus to, you know, support the poor. The other thing is that we have these state-owned entities, so we could actually utilize money differently. But we are at a point where money is allocated towards state-owned entities. I know you're going on an ad break, but I'll...
I'll give you a chance to continue before we debate some of these solutions. But also, why don't you give a call? We've got three excellent brains here. You've listened to them very patiently and in detail, and I'm enthralled by their expertise. What questions have you got? Where do you agree, disagree? What do you think is really strategically the way forward to deal with the joblessness crisis? The one thing we can all agree on, regardless of our political and ideological orientation, is that if we don't deal with this crisis, it's going to come back to bite us in the behinds as a country. 011-883-0702.
Connect.
Engage.
Change.
This is 702 for the curious.
24 minutes before 11 o'clock, we're hanging out with Neil Coleman from Institute for Economic Justice, Isabel Fry, who's with Studies in Poverty and Inequalities Institute, and Dr. Tabi Lioko, who's an economist, of course. And we're trying to get to the bottom of how we're going to solve this problem of the jobs crisis. And one of the, I just said on Twitter, one of the unique joys of having a mid-morning show is that we have the breathing space to get into the complexity of these issues rather than looking for quick sound bites to really difficult socioeconomic complexities. Vusi, good morning to you. What is your question or your comment?
Hi, you serious first time caller. So my comment is that, you know, if we are going to fight the issue of joblessness and, you know, attracting investment, we need to look at the current environment, and currently it's not conducive in attracting investment, because you've got powerful unions and at the same time you've got stringent labor laws. So and I don't know how, but you need to find a way of curtailing the power of unions.
I get your question. Isabel is losing her left wing cool here. She'll respond in a second. Leshlocho Nolo, good morning.
You see, there's a new case. I'm talking from an employer's perspective. I'm in mining sector, Eusebius, and the direct cause of unemployment that I have witnessed.
Yes.
In fact, we've got we're running 9 mines in South Africa, 9-5, and we're running another 4 in Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
It's productivity level that ultimately talks to both the side of Botswana side and South African side. We're making more money in Botswana than in South Africa on simple things like productivity level, so much that we've closed one mine in Mpumalanga just in March, and we're taking those assets into Botswana purely because political instability in South Africa has, you know, spilled over into workplace, so much that even the workforce that we have are so polluted that they don't understand productivity. In so doing, we have unfortunately retrenched almost 120 people just in March.
Never let me forget that what I say in the break is clearly going to come onto this show. But thank you, and thank you, Vusi. I think that it's a really important point to unpack. From my perspective, I don't think the labor movement has been weaker in our 25 years of democracy than it is now. I think with internal divisions, I've been very concerned to see how that voice of the working class seems to be reduced. We need to see unions really in terms of the structure of the economy. One of the reasons why the German economy, for instance, is so strong is that unions have a place at the table. They literally, you've got workers on the boards of companies. And the point being that workers have got a view in terms of having a sustainable company that they're working at, where you exclude workers and you exclude organized workers through the unions, then what you have is you're setting up sort of toe-to-toe. And so the workers are seen as the enemy. They shouldn't be seen as the enemy. But the other point is that where unions have always managed to maintain a very strong position is on the structure of the economy and the fact that you need to redistribute through salaries, through the national minimum wage. And Tabi was unpacking.
But what do you say to people who say to that argument, which is where Vusi is coming from, right? And the argument is a familiar one, but I want your view on it very quickly. The cost curve needs to be as low as possible, and the incentive must be there to come and do business in the country. And if you're going to be worried about decreasing the gap between the highest paid people at the top, the bassons, and the lowest paid people in the global corporation in your country, that's all fine and well from an ethical point of view. But at the end of the day, FDI depends on whether or not I think I can come into your territory and maximize shareholder value. And when you are talking about labor rights, making it difficult to hire and fire people, increasing the minimum wage levels, that may be good. There may be a good political and historical reason for those arguments. But I'm going to China, I'm going to Australia, and I'm going to go and set up my mining operation there. Thank you. Bye. Or Botswana.
And that is an argument you hear a lot. The point is, if you want to go in and be rapacious and take out the profits immediately, that is your modus operandi. If you want to have an economy that grows, if you want to have an economy that's there for your children, and something which is developed and diversified, then you can't just take that very short, narrow, selfish approach.
Okay.
It is about investing, growing, and seeing different people's vested interests in the same action, which is the productivity.
Mm. Neil, can you kindly do two things for me? Can you respond to Leslie Honolo, who says, well, productivity levels are low, and if they were only higher and South Africans weren't as lazy, you generate more value, which presumably with a little bit of economic causal analysis will eventually lead to more stimulation of growth. And then the second thing is, please come back and just wrestle with what Tubby had said, that some of the things that you were speaking about in terms of stimulus, et cetera, it's fine, but we can't be blind to what is happening in the state and the fiscus.
Okay, so on the wages productivity nexus, you see there's actually a connection between Vusi and I think it was Leslie Sonono's question, which is that if you have a lack, if you have a wage repression strategy, then what you actually do is you dampen productivity and you dampen the participation of workers and unions in actually raising the level of productivity. So, I mean, the IMF has looked at this and has basically said high levels of inequality are very bad for economic development and economic growth. I mean, it's coming from the IMF, and they actually looked at places where collective bargaining and trade unions were weak, and they said that led to growing levels of inequality, which is very bad for economic growth. So there's a relationship between those things.
Mm.
You know, on the issue of economic stimulus. I mean, the president has announced and said that we need an economic stimulus package. And this is actually official government policy. You know, if you look in the policy documents, they say when the economy is contracting, you need a stimulatory economic policy. I mean, this is economics 101. It's called counter-cyclical economic policy. So the question is, what are the levers that are available to government to do that? And one of the key levers is the question of fiscal stimulus. And another is the issue of monetary stimulus. Now, if interest rates are being reduced and small businesses, for example, are not getting access to cheap credit, that is also because of the monopolies and concentration in the banking system. You know, we have one of the highest spreads between the rates that the Reserve Bank charges, the interest rates, and what the commercial banks actually charge, which is 3.5% above that.
Yes.
So there has to be a strategy to bring the cost of credit down. And there's no sense in saying that well, because there's no growth, therefore there's no point in bringing the cost of credit down, because the cost of credit is a key factor in retarding economic growth. And the issue of access to, you know, fiscal space, there's a big debate about that. And internationally, there's agreement that the levels of debt, you know, including, again, by the IMF, you know, for example, South Africa, the levels of debt, although a lot of people see it as a crisis, are relatively not that high by international standards. The issue is not the question of debt. It's the question of how you use borrowing to invest in infrastructure, in productive expenditure, in a way that generates economic growth, which then allows you to generate the resources required to retire that debt.
Tabi, can we move to a different theme? There are different kinds of unemployment. We've already been introduced by both Neil and Isabel to the importance of, in understanding the horror of our crisis, things like long-term unemployment, how long people have been unemployed. And then you see that the stats don't even tell you half of the reality of what people are experiencing. You want to come back to this conceptual but also practical question around different levels of unemployment. And so then after you've done that, let's get back to education. I'm a little bit still confused. I get the stat that Isabel cited, how not having a matric correlates particularly horribly with being unemployed. But I'd like to understand, in a counterfactual scenario, how improvement in education, which we need for many, many reasons, how that will help to decimate these stats.
All right.
Can I just point something out before Tabi responds on that, you see, Bruce?
Go ahead, Neil.
You know, the stat that I quoted earlier was that while 7.9% of graduates are unemployed, if you actually look at the 15 to 24-year age cohort, 31% are unemployed. And the number of graduates that are unemployed is increasing in that age cohort, as well as the 25 to 34 years.
That makes sense.
So we need to drill down into that figure.
Yeah.
And if the demand is not there, you can create as many graduates as you like.
That's true.
It's not going to resolve the question of unemployment.
That makes sense to me. Yeah. Tabi?
So we often talk about unemployment without talking about why, you know, there is this unemployment in South Africa. And there are various reasons, and this is not just for South Africa, but globally. I think in South Africa, one of, you know, the most obvious reason is the geographical immobility, the fact that the centers of employment are far from most South Africans. And that's why you see that in the stats, poverty and unemployment is concentrated along African and female youth, especially those living in rural areas and townships, because it's the immobility. You also have occupational immobility, and this is the kind of unemployment which occurs when a candidate is unable to learn a new skill, which is needed in a new industry. You also have technological.
What does that mean practically? Making UCBS a skills, fit for fourth industrial.
Exactly, where the skill cannot be transferred.
Okay.
And then often due to technological changes, and then you have the problem of technological change. Which is then you're a farmer and it's, or you're a farm worker, and the farmer decides that he's going to mechanize. And so then you are left to be unemployed, and you also see that in the mining sector. There's also things like, you know, the structural change in an economy, and this would happen in a sector such as mining, where the commodity price weakens, and then it results in a shutting down of mines. And labor is then let go. So you have also real and classical unemployment, voluntary unemployment, cyclical unemployment, and youth unemployment. So you have a whole host of types of unemployment, and to a lesser extent, this mismatch, the skills mismatch that we have. I don't think we're interrogating this enough, especially the geographical immobility. The other thing that, you know, on the structure of the economy, and so we mentioned, and I mentioned that between 15 and 65-year-olds, not in education, employment and training, they're about just less than 40%. These are people who are unlikely to go back to school to get that education that we all talk about. I think there's an overemphasis on education equals a job. Right. And let me just show you the statistics.
And that's partly Neil's point, though, right, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we all often use education as this incredible silver bullet. If my Angie and a higher education counterpart, or whoever that will be the ones taking over both portfolios in the next government, were to be the best performing ministers, how will that likely contribute, not perfectly, but importantly and notably, to a reduction in unemployment?
Absolutely. So in South Africa, of, let's just say, 100 children start school, about 60% will reach and write matric.
Uh-huh.
37 will pass matric. 12 will access university. Only 4 will complete university in 6 years. So obviously we have a very low throughput. And this is this relates to the level and the quality of education, of basic education, which needs to be looked at. So we have that problem. We also have a problem of not promoting entrepreneurship in the country and small and medium-sized enterprises. If you look at other countries such as Russia and Turkey, there's huge entrepreneurship amongst those who don't have a university degree but have a matric, an equivalent of matric. But it's obviously a good one, because these are people who can go out into the go out and start their own companies. And you're not seeing the same or similar trend in South Africa. Now, going back to what I described about the structure of the South African economy, we are growing. The sectors that are growing are the sectors that shouldn't be the fastest growing sectors, because they don't employ as many South Africans. And they are also high skilled sectors.
That's part of Neil's point, right? Financial services and that kind of thing.
Financial service, insurance and stuff. So people like us who are educated can always hop a job hop. And it's a matter of time before we get to the next job. Whereas those who are between 15 and 65 years old, who are, 38% of the economy, cannot do that, because they actually are not even in education, employment and training. So we've actually neglected those throughout the past,
I want to take a break. Okay, I need to take a break, and I want to come back, and I want Isabel to get back to Brazil, which she has fantasies of being on holiday there right now, but also what we can learn from that case. I just want to press you here, though, just for just the 30 seconds, right? Some people will say, okay, but education is necessary, but not the perfect sine qua non for dealing with jobs. It doesn't guarantee it, because if you don't have a complicated set of new industries that you focus on beyond financial services, for example, then quite frankly, you're still going to have jobless graduates, even if they suddenly know how to use computers and how to code and what have you. How do we deal with that? Because it seems to take us back to orthodoxy. We need FDI.
We need FDI, but also we need to support entrepreneurship.
Okay.
We need to do it in a way that is very targeted. You saw it in Asia, from supporting even financially, where banks take a risk on small and medium-sized entities, to also taking a bank on Gogo Kumalo, that you like so much, who runs a spaza shop in a township. Why is Gogo Kumalo running a spaza shop after 10 years?
Absolutely.
Why hasn't that spaza shop graduated into a supermarket?
That's right. And it's Gogo Dlamini.
No. Live. Transform. This is 702. This is 702. For the curious.
We've got 3 to 4 minutes left. I want you guys on for like 2 hours. And I always struggle to get Neil on, as much as I love his brain. I'm going to give you 2 minutes and shut up. And then Neil will have the final minute. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. 2 minutes starting now. I think a lot of your views have been aired in this debate. For me, what's critical is that you're starting, you're framing, and Neil as well said this. This is a crisis, and we can't just continue to look at it from a distance. Everybody says things can't be done. They're not done in comparative countries, but they are. I think it's time to go back to the empirical evidence. For me, the easiest way for immediate stabilization is through social protection, social security. Mm-hmm. The multipliers, the second round effects of that investment is there. Where it comes from, a lot of the global empirical evidence goes back to the fact of taxing wealth, because you've got to reduce the inequality. Also, as the other two speakers,
what does Brazil teach us?
Brazil teaches us that a bolsa familiar, which is similar to a basic income grant, okay, is something which brings money into households. We don't need conditional cash transfers here, because children go to school, children go to clinics when the clinics are open. But that whole idea of transferring wealth into the homes. The other thing
What would be, sorry, 2 minutes is a long time in radio. What would be your preferred mechanism for transferring wealth?
through a wealth tax. The accumulated wealth in this country is incredibly high.
Okay.
And then you distribute it through a cash transfer, because we've got people, we've got Home Affairs. You don't need to have bureaucrats who trained in that. What I also wanted to come to quickly, however, was the question about data, about how people are marginalized. Poverty rests in the provinces, and that's where poverty is growing. We need to look at public transport so people can move, can go to seek opportunities. We need to reduce the cost of data. We need to have free Wi-Fi in areas so that kids, even if they're not employed, are connected globally and are able to see things, are able to produce songs, put those out there. And then I was talking to someone in the comms sector who said loading up content itself is very labor intensive, and that's something where we can look at. We can create our own devices here. There are very many ways of revolutionizing, but those people who make the decisions are steeped in this fact that it hasn't been done before by our World Bank advisors.
And then finally, in 20 seconds, a basic income grant appeals to Tavi and I, who know all about black tax and other ills in society, but we are worried about cost. What do you say to us? Can we afford it?
We can afford it, and there's a lot of work that's been done around that. The actual cost is probably about $100 billion per annum, and there's certainly ways we can start reducing middle class tax refunds and rebates. That will generate quite a high level, and also using negative income tax. But it is not unaffordable, and for years that information has been made available to policymakers who, for ideological reasons, reject it.
Neil, you've got 50 seconds. Close us out.
Well, the president's promising to clean up the state, which is great. But unless we have a new economic deal which addresses these fundamental economic problems, we're going to generate the structural features which lead to corruption and parasitic relationships, both by people in business and in the state. And we need a stimulus package. We need the stabilization measures along the lines of what Isabel was talking about. But most importantly, we need to structurally transform the nature of our economy.
Mm. Okay, Tabi, 15 seconds, quickly.
So we often talk about Switzerland as a country that is perfect in many ways, very advanced, very sophisticated. 70% of the Swiss population don't have degrees. 70% vocational training. Only 30% of their population has degrees.
Where are you going?
Isabel, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it. Tabi, thanks for coming into the studio. Neil, not Goldman, Coleman. Thank you for coming on, Neil.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Martin.